around the tree and remaining being come to order. Today is Friday, April 8th, and the time is 8:05 a.m. in the Betty Davis Committee Room in the Alaska State Capitol in Juneau. Members of House Education present are Pro Chair Representative Amy Sorin, Representative Ron Dillon, Representative Brian Hopkins, and myself, Representative Chair Harriet Dillon. I'm looking for reps and presses on Teams, but she's not here yet. Okay. We have a call to conduct business before we begin. I'd like to remind everyone to please lower their cell phones. Today, our remote recording secretary is Lori Bowman, and Lydia Klein is our LIM moderator assisting with technical conferencing support. Thank you both. Today, we have a presentation from Dr. Dana DeFeo and Dr. Matthew Berman of the Institute of Social and Economic Research on Alaska per pupil K-12 spending. Dr. DeFeo is on Teams, and Dr. Berman is or will be on the teleconference line listening in. If you would please state your names and affiliations for the record and begin your affiliation. Also, please tell us next slide, and my staff will move it on. And in addition, we do not have to go to the floor. The House floor this morning is at your meeting, so we can take the full 2 hours if you need. So, go ahead, Dr. DeFeo.
Cost differentials and cost of living indices. So that's the broad for directions are going to be able to negotiate as they next slide.
Well, I'd like to
comment on any kind of questions. Okay. So we'll start the top one with just 4 hours, and I'm going to do something today that's a little out of character for researchers, but I've been coached by our communications director. What we tend to do with researchers is we present all of the background and all of the methods, sometimes probably ad nauseum, and then we give you the findings like right at the end. But what we're trying to do is give you the findings up front and then to go back and explain the process and then come back to the findings. This is a little unusual for me to do it, but I understand this makes sense to just like cut to the chase at the beginning. So just go to slide 4, which would be the next slide. If you are about raw dollars in our average for people spending. So, as I said earlier, these data come from the U.S. Census Bureau's annual survey of school system finances. And in 2017, these are the numbers that I testified to in February, Alaska's for people spending was about 46% higher than the national average when we're looking at raw dollars. At that time, it was also the sixth highest state in the nation. But the latest numbers that we have, these are figures from 2019, because the national data are reported on a bit of a lag. These show that Alaska is still in the sixth place, but our per pupil spending has dropped to just 39% higher than the national average. And as we all know, in 2019, the economy was growing faster nationally than it was in Alaska. And so other states, like Oklahoma, the state for Alabama, since they could get less historically on education, we're able to invest more dollars. And so that sort of shows how our relative position will probably change over time. So those are the raw dollars, but to go to slide 5, the raw dollars show that we spend about $5,000 more per student than the national average here in Alaska. But to really make a comparison, it's not quite that straightforward. There are 2 points that I'd like to make here. First is that the high cost of living in rural Alaska, we're all familiar with it, it skews the average for the state. And then even in urban Alaska, the living costs are higher than the U.S. average based on most cost of living indices. So that's what I'm going to talk about in this section of the presentation, is adjusting these rural dollars so that we can compare apples to apples. So the next slide is slide 6. Here I'm showing you the findings again before I told you how we got there, which is unusual for me, but here we go. So to interpret this chart, the thick black line that's starting to the left side of the chart is the national average. And what we've done here is represented the percent above or below from the 2017 numbers that we identified to before and the updated 2019 numbers, which are the darker green bar. So everything that we're talking about is sort of in relation to that black line relative to the national average. And so the top bar is the raw dollars, this is the ones that I've been showing you. And the light green bar on the very top, this is the 46% higher that I talked about before. The dark green is the 2019 numbers where I said we're 39% higher. But we did apply two adjustments to the raw dollars, which I'll go into more detail in the next slides. But so first, first we had to do, we know that things in Alaska communities cost different amounts. So we adjusted the state spending to Anchorage dollars, and just doing that adjustment by itself explained more than half of the difference between Alaska spending and the national average. So you can see that in the second set of green bar. Just doing the state adjustment cut our difference in half. But then we know that things in Anchorage, since we adjusted everything to Anchorage, we know that things there tend to cost more than they do in other places in the U.S. So we applied a second set of adjustments to get those Anchorage dollars. And when we did that, as you can see in the bottom two bars, which are below that black line, or to the left of that black line, we were pretty close to the national average in 2017, just 2 percentage points below, but 7 points below in 2019.
Slide, and then I'll try to answer the question.
same time. And the duplicate of this slide is 0.9. So we were going to come back to it again or expand after some more explanation. But I'm happy to take questions at any time to make this a bit dialogue. I was just going to say that the 2020 numbers are not out yet, but we would expect the last sending to be lower relative to the national average because, like I said, other states are investing more. And so in the next slide, I was just going to show my graph, or show Matt's map, really, a little background in more detail about how we did this. But I'm certainly happy to take your question now if that's what you'd like.
That's thanks for being here. Just out of curiosity, your research that you did, so is it $1,319,394 for the NEA spent $20,553. I know that surprise speech has a higher cost of living than Alaska does. So did you compare Alaska with any of those states or your states, did you compare to how many of you?
Sure, I can let Dr. Berman jump in, but I would say that these data did come from the U.S. Census Bureau's federal school finances, and the reason that we use those is that all school districts in the nation and all states are required to report using sort of the same formula, which allows us to compare. And so when we do the national average, you know, this includes all 50 states, and Matt may be able to indicate whether or not that also includes D.C., except D.C. might be in there as well. So this is everybody states that have higher cost of living or poor communities that do as well as the lower income communities.
Thank you for the time. Welcome back to the panel. Could you say again the name of the report from the U.S. Census Bureau?
Through the chair, I apologize that I missed that piece of the form before. It's the United States Census Bureau's annual survey of school system finances. Through the chair, I think that Dr. Berman might be able to speak in more detail about the data that it contains, but it is a uniform standard of reporting that's used by all 50 states. And so when we want to compare, we want to make sure that we're measuring things and defining all of these costs in the same way. And since most states are required to use it, including Alaska, it allows us to make a clear comparison than some of the other ways that these things can be calculated. And that's not to say that other calculations are not more accurate, particularly in Alaska. I know that Alaska has put out phenomenal numbers. So we recognize that that's a limitation of this analysis, is that we're using this national model of defining variables. But if we want to compare, this is the only thing that allows us to do that broad 50 state comparison. To my knowledge, and like you said, Dr. Berman, has something to add.
Census survey and
Dr. Berman, you said the national. Yeah, the national survey is not as efficient as the census.
Thank you. And I don't know if this is just identifying myself. This is for the record. This is Dr. Devine speaking. I would also note, in addition to what we just said, that the survey data for all of these, for all of this, is publicly available. So you can go in and look at raw numbers and see spreadsheets ad nauseum. They're very good for analysis. The data that come from the Census Bureau, they're not the most interesting things to look at because you do sort of have to. Analysis to them often, and I will look at that in a study and see if my published numbers or just conclusions and findings. That would be an important consideration as to how they could be used for our type of work. But to go to the next slide, I can talk a little bit about the adjustments that we did. Starting out with that $18,384, which again are 2019 numbers. The 2020 ones at the national level are not yet available. So with that $18,384, I want to stress that this is an average. So it includes the cost for different places and different programs, and we know that those can vary quite a bit, but averages are also useful figures when we do an exercise like this, talking about statewide spending. So our first adjustment was the statewide adjustment, and what we did is we adjusted the spending in the state almost with the average. And I think that's a pretty common thing to do in Alaska. We tend to talk about costs relative to acreage. And so the first step was to calculate this acreage-adjusted average per pupil spending number. And so to do this, we used the foundation formula's geographic cost differential, and we weighted that for the district average daily membership to level the differences in costs within Alaska. That's how we got that 15,290. And in the next slide, actually, if I could go to slide 8, but then we'll come back to 7, I thought this was helpful to just visualize these costs a little bit. These are the community cost differentials. These need some updating, but knowing that that they've not been updated in a while, that's a different topic. But as you can see, all of these initially call my field currently as two school districts. The cost differential there is more than 1.5 times acreage, and so I thought this was a useful chart because it shows not just how significantly different the costs are when we look at some of our communities, but also how many communities that this applies to who are experiencing these higher costs higher than acreage. So if I could pop back to slide 7, unless people want to spend a little more time on slide 8, I don't know. Those adjustments brought us to the 15,290, but that's still the acreage adjusted costs. And, because the average cost of living is higher than most communities in the U.S. or most cities in the U.S., for that part of the analysis, the final step, we applied the most widely used cost of living index. So, I don't know if this would shake up, but we used one that's published by the Council for Community and Economic Research. And that was formerly known, probably you're more familiar Office of the Community and Economic Research, so same, same group, just a new acronym, new name. So we used that cost of living index applied to the statewide calculations, and that's how we got the 12-1081, which is, I indicated earlier, 7 percentage points below the national average in 2019. So I think from here, if there are no comments, we can go back to slide 9. I'm sorry, don't skip ahead to slide 9 because they've already seen slide 8. This is just showing, again, slide 6 that we've already seen, but I wanted and built in this slide as a pause for any questions or comments up to this point, but of course, children, if you would prefer to just keep going, that's fine. I wanted to do what's best for everybody. Okay, so in slide 10, this comparison is a lot less scientific, but I was thinking that there's data and looking at costs in other ways outside of national averages, and so, you know, when we're trying to put things in perspective, sometimes another example helps. So I just thought this is a Google search, this is not scientific research, but I looked at credit school tuition in Anchorage, and when I looked at the Pacific Northern Academy, their tuition costs, at least according to their website, are pretty close to that national average, to the Alaska average before the ETL. And, you know, daycare costs in Alaska, according to Thread, are about $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year. So this comparison to private schools is helpful to put things in perspective, but I'm also going to caution that schools, private schools, operate very differently than public schools. They have different responsibilities. So private schools can both get donations to offset tuition costs, and they tend to do that quite a bit. That allows them to reduce tuition. But private schools also don't have the responsibilities for things like transportation and also intensive special education. Those are things that our public schools provide. But even with that, I was interested to see that the advertised tuition amounts were still somewhat comparable. So, but since that was a less scientific approach, I'll just move on to slide 11 and to ask that question about what drives these cost calculation, drives the cost that we see.
I heard you say that private schools don't have the responsibility for transportation or for certain special education costs. Could you clarify that just a little bit?
Of course, private schools generally have the right to determine which students will be accepted into their programs, and so they can, they don't have the requirement to accept all students, and students, including students that have had rates of services that they would need for special education, they certainly are not impacted in either student's entry, but they have the option of turning away students who might not meet their, I'm trying to think of the right word, apologize, I am a little sick today, but they have the option of screening students that would fit into their institutions, and so they might not have to serve students with some of those intensive special education needs that are quite expensive.
And of course, the special education intensive needs are required to be provided by the local public school. Is it your understanding that students in a private school can go to the local public school for certain special education needs? Or are you saying that the private school would screen those students and not necessarily accept them in their school?
I'm just noting that private schools may screen those individuals or those individuals who might be accepted into the private schools choose to get services, probably varies. But I note that when you look at the school foundation formula, special education is one of the things that we consider, and that the private schools, while having costs comparable to the Alaska average, actually are not responsible for all of the same things that our public schools do. And I don't know if Dr. Berman wanted to weigh in on that at all.
Dr. Bergen, I see. So I'm saying that perhaps any anecdotal papers from the 2020 study. Thank you, Representative Kwok. That's a question.
Are those sort of numbers a little bit scant compared to the national average? Because I know we include our first mother's kids at 49. Yeah, I don't believe that it's safe to include first mother's kids in our study. So would our numbers be scattered in school labs? That's the question.
Again, thank you.
We're at, let's see, the private school commission. You can talk about the Montessori program over exit taking cost.
So, I just noted from the website the costs that were advertised, and I did note that the end-of-the-year costs come from the THREAD program, and these are at least the average of $1,000 a month for infant daycare. And these numbers, like I said, I just pulled, but I was interested to see when we're spending $18,000 per pupil, or $18,000 per pupil, for all of the services that we provide in our public education system, what other programs serving youth charge for their users. And that's all that this slide was meant to do, was introduce another way to think about these numbers. But to get more to the scientific way of looking at things with the drivers of costs in slide 11, which looks like it's up on the screen, knowing what we spend and knowing how much it is relative to the national average and knowing how much it is if we adjust it to a geographic setting, I think it's important to note that, you know, because these numbers are not, we are paying for education. So in this section of the presentation, I'd like to talk about some of the drivers of those costs, which, you know, might be areas of opportunity for policy, of course. So in slide 12, in this section of the presentation, I'm going to talk about three things: small schools, healthcare, and energy. And of course, we've already talked about the last of geography that's driving the cost. But I also want to, before I talk about what evidence we have that these costs come, evidence of where the costs come from, is also where the costs are not an issue. It's not that we're paying teachers too much. In fact, we also looked at this in 2015, a completely different study than the one that you have in front of you. But we estimated that teachers were paid on average about 15% below what they needed to be paid. And Alaska has a goal of attracting and retaining good teachers in our schools. And so that salary, of course, varies by job type, by community type. But on average, Alaska's salaries are not too high based on the research. It's also not about if you're contributions to our retirement system. But I will look at these small schools, healthcare, and energy. So to move to slide 13, the last of small schools, I'm just going to say that Alaska has a whole lot of them. Looking at data from the Regional Education Lab Northwest, they said that they last reported that more than 90 of Alaska schools have fewer than 50 students or fewer. So that's a lot of schools in our program, more than 20%, in our state, more than 20%. And on the right-hand side of this slide, I'll note that we have a legal responsibility and an ethical responsibility to provide public education to all students. So that's very clear. And so we've got some schools that are here to stay for a while, but they are more costly to operate. And this probably makes sense just at face value. They don't benefit from the economies of scale. When you're looking at capital costs or labor costs, they tend to have small class sizes. So no matter how many students are in a classroom, you need at least one teacher there. And our research also indicates that small schools tend to have higher turnover for both principals and teachers, and then that also significantly adds to their costs. So that's one of our drivers, is small schools. In slide 14, I've got Alaska's healthcare costs. And I'll note on the right-hand side of the slide, we didn't do these adjustments of the 2019 data. I didn't look closely until we started preparing the talk this week. But in 2017, we looked at benefit costs. And in 2017, so using some older data, even though when we did our adjustments, our per pupil spending was 2% below the national average, our adjusted cost of benefits, and that makes up a portion of the per pupil spending, that's for 11% above the national average. And a big chunk of that benefit package is healthcare costs. So nothing in Alaska has better benefits than other states. Not doing that kind of comparison, I'm just saying that we pay more for them. And evidence that our benefits are just costly is that other research from Eisner notes that Alaska has the highest healthcare costs in the United States. That's fair for all sectors of our economy, not just education. This isn't a unique problem for education, but what it does is when you have this big budget scenario and you have to pay for healthcare, that's just going to put downward pressure on wages. And that makes it more difficult for Alaska districts to offer competitive salaries when they're trying to recruit teachers to come and work here. So healthcare is a tricky one. And then the slide 15 is energy. I think that there are two components I'd like to look at with energy. One is the cost of energy and the amount needed, and both of these things are very highly variable. So we all know that energy costs are variable from week to week in the nation, but fuel costs not only fluctuate over time, but by geography. So, for example, if you need to transport with the road fuel in like a small community that doesn't have water access, that costs more. And also, the creators might not be able to get the best prices when they make the fuel purchases. And of course, you need electricity. We know that electricity costs more in remote places, and that schools, just about before the schools don't benefit from the power cost equalization programs, that sort of offset the higher electricity costs for local residents. So we've got variable costs and fluctuating costs. But regardless of what the fuel and the electricity cost districts need to keep the buildings, they need to turn the lights on, no matter how many students there are. And those, the amount of fuel that you need also can vary significantly in colder climates. It costs more, in colder years it costs more. So it's not just the cost of what you're going to pay for it, but how much you need that can be difficult to estimate. And when you have that on with the costs are changing constantly, that can really be a tricky budgetary thing for districts to plan for.
Dr. McLean, you may not be aware that on Monday, Diane Hirschberg made some pretty famous rundown on the energy costs of schools. Ooh. And that was a serious discussion. Well, thank you. Any questions at this point? Okay. Okay, Dr. McLean.
That actually brings us to the last part of the presentation in slide 16. Your are just to a I need to say, I originally planned for about a half hour, so I didn't prepare all that much, but I'm happy to stay and continue to talk. On slide 17, I just wanted to sort of conclude with some takeaways. One of the points that I wanted to make is, there are lots of things that drive up losses for people standing that are beyond education policy. And it's not, look up to what Alaska spends and try to put that spending into a national context with Dr. Berman felt, but it's not just how much we spend, but where these dollars go. So a lot of these things are beyond education policy. Fuel is bigger than education, healthcare is bigger than education, the basket of goods for reality, but what things cost more in Anchorage than they do, in other cities in the U.S., and they cost more and more in Alaska than they do in Anchorage. Those are just bigger issues than education. But as long as these are realities, I think it's fair to say that Alaska really should expect them to influence our education spending. So when I look at these 2-year differences in Alaska's spending relative to the national average, what that tells me is that other states are investing more in public education. And I think that's going to be a big deal for Alaska because, actually, I've known that the 2020 numbers were out. Dr. Berman and I probably going to want to take a look at this. But, teacher of Alaska might not know the exact figures that I testified to today, but my teacher lives and works, within the conditions and resources that public education spending covers. And so, Alaska does not produce all of the teachers that it needs to hire every year. So we're competing for teachers that come to Alaska. We're competing in a national market. And if Alaska wants to be competitive in attracting teachers, it needs to make sure that things like working conditions and benefit systems and salaries are good. And that's in comparison to the other offers and options that teachers have. And of course, it's not just teachers that need competitive resources and facilities. It's an investment in our students, too. So that was all that I had prepared to say. On slide 18, it has my contact information and Dr. Berman's, but I'm certainly happy to stay for questions or comments if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. DeFeo, I just want to let you know that we are working on updating the district cost factors. Grant study, Dr. Hirschner told us, was last updated in the mid-2000s, and it's long past time to get that done, and I think that may change your slide 8 significantly, maybe the differentials. All right, questions, discussion, Representative Clark, Representative Blum.
I have a few questions. I guess, I appreciate the study, but I guess I'm going to go back to the same question. How many correlated funding with student outcomes? That is the basic question I have to ask. I have another question, but I'm not sure if you want to tackle that one.
So, through the chair, that's not what the study did in particular. I think that would be a useful thing to look at is how schools are resourced. It's a little tricky to get down to the granular levels of schools and communities that may differ significantly, even within a single district. But I would say that it would be great to know what outcomes you're looking to study, and we would be great at thinking about how to measure them and how we might be able to do that analysis, but that is beyond the scope of this particular work.
Based on funding.
through the chair, I can say that says something about the work with different families and the way forward, but I would, so the first we need to run to our really focus on, kind of that we're looking to prepare and move the needle on. Some things in Alaska are tricky to prepare, depending on how students request it or what type of curriculum we use. But we first need to identify what outcomes we're looking to measure. And we also know that there are a lot of things that influence students' education outcomes that are beyond what we invest in schools. And these things are related to many things, but income is a significant one. So the analysis will also need to take into consideration the school investment, but some of the other things that we know make education more tricky in some schools and some communities. And I don't know if Dr. Berman would like to weigh in on that, but I would add, too, I think there are a lot of variables that go into this hopper of how students ultimately perform, everything from parents to communities to schools. And a study that really was trying to identify some type of a causal connection between funding and student outcomes, we need to take into account those other variables. So it's, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think it's tricky, and I would love for Dr. Berman to add because this is more of his methods.
Getting them acclimated to their communities and their dreams.
system than we have been on average. So we have a lot of things coming up over there. Representative Kahn, I think, wanted to go back to his question.
Maybe this is the wrong question here to discuss this, but I keep going back to what I said. I think the high energy is the more left. I think those are constants. We don't have arguments, but my bottom line question is we always get asked for more money. Okay, so whenever we are we going to be guaranteed based on outcomes? And if we can't correlate those outcomes, why are we having this conversation? We need to go to policy discussion. So, I hope all the other members understand the bottom line question is we have all these factors, we have all these costs, and I understand that. But the bottom line is, does more money correlate better success in the classroom? And one of the questions I'm going to have to do, and I don't know if you're going to say this, but we always talk about high teacher pupil ratios. So, we have a lot of schools that are very low number students. If that holds true, those should be very high achieving schools because we know they're very small classes. That's the kind of information I mean, I'm hoping, I'm not trying to play, you know, devil's advocate or anything, but these are the things that I'm thinking about as a teacher. I want to make sure, any extra outcome, I want to make sure we're producing educated students that is as necessary grade by grade 3. I don't need somebody's likely income, you know, outcome at the end. I just want to make sure we're producing educated students that when they graduate, they make a choice of how they're going to live. That's how I look at it. Thank you.
In a nutshell, I wouldn't say it. When fixed costs increase, like health care, like energy, those issues, it's not because they don't find that puts down the pressure on the rest of the budget. And salaries that teachers, people have to be cut when that happens. And we end up with higher pupil teacher ratios because there are fewer teachers. It's much harder for each student to get the attention that they need from a teacher who has way more students in the classroom than they would. That are optimal. And we know that's a problem in large districts, and it's a problem in small districts. Small districts have a much higher turnover of teachers. And go back to that comparison I just made. When you have high teacher turnover, you have lower student outcomes because the students can't trust that their teacher will be there the next year. There are ways to improve that, but you can't stop teachers from leaving the community. That's not all the idea. And unless something improves, and Dr. DeFeo did talk about what needs to improve, and we know we need to make those improvements.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to two things in response. As teacher turnover, that you mentioned that Dr. Perry had testified around, I'm happy to talk about this as teacher turnover. There's a lead author on that teacher turnover study that calculated both costs and it looked pretty closely at some of our patterns. So I would like to note to what Representative Grock had just said about the low number of students in classrooms and where the last go. What I note there is a really challenging working condition that while a teacher might have a small classroom, they're often teaching multiple grades, and sometimes multiple subjects or other subjects that they've been training for. And so I would note that a lot of the literature that says small class sizes produce better student outcomes is looking at just a little bit. A bunch of third graders, and whether you have a class of 20 or 30 third graders who are all learning the same thing and covering the same curriculum. I think the small classes in rural Alaska have another layer of complexity that challenges the teaching working conditions. And so, what I would also note is that correlating our outcomes to spending, as Dr. Berman said, is super tricky. But one of the things that I would consider or suggest starting. As an adequacy study, NASA has not done an adequacy study to say, like, you know, instead of looking at dollars that we invest in per pupil, let's look at what actual resources, the literature and research show predicts the outcomes that we desire to have, and make sure that we're providing at least that minimum adequate threshold of education services. And so I think we need to start there. You know, they try to make the correlation, but we don't even know if what we're doing is adequate. I guess we could say it also could be too much, but I think that's the place to start, is to correlate what we're investing, to focus more on what it is that we're actually creating, the infrastructure and structure for education, making sure that aligns to the literature that tells us that they should produce good outcomes, and then from that solid foundation to ask the questions of comparing outcomes across classes.
That may help quality school system, so to speak, that is predicted to raise achievement. Is that
correct? Well, through the chair, that is correct. We asked myself and Emily Kostin and Hirschberg actually facilitated that study. It was conducted by Larry Pappas out of UCLA. I think there's a very small pool of effort to be able to actually conduct a study of that type, but they also rely on local people to facilitate it. So I know that the study was, I'm not sure if it was the school board who ordered it. I know that the CFO at the time, Mark Foster, was involved, and I'm going to guess that was 2014 or 15, but you couldn't quote me on that. But that's when that was done, and how the Anchorage School Board decided to act on those recommendations. So I couldn't speak to that, but they did go through the process of an adequacy study. That is correct. I would also know that the Council 278 in, I'm going to say around 2014, did call for an adequacy study of education in Alaska. It was the same bill that called for the study of teacher salary and tenure that Dr. Bennett and I and Dr. Bushrow worked on. I know the study was not completed. It's my understanding that it may not have even received bids. I'm not sure. But one has been called for by the legislature that has not yet been executed at state level.
Does that include federal, state, and local spending?
interested in the data much more recently.
That's really difficult to correlate, especially as it applies.
tonight to Dana Cross, Representative Cross.
Well, thank you. You're probably incorrect. But that is the sort of stuff that I think we need to bring in and take a look at. That, I don't want to sort of assume that everybody has to be doing everything exactly the same way. And perhaps the fact that it does cost considerably capital costs in Alaska are considerably higher. Perhaps we need to look at a different asset mix or capital investment in a different way of delivering the service that didn't depend on the more high cost methods of delivering the service. I think that would be more helpful to delivery
and delivery. And of course, there's the cost of broadband or the even availability of broadband in order to be able to deliver education remotely. When broadband access doesn't even exist in some of these communities, that option simply isn't here. And of course, that's also a capital cost. It's hopefully will be addressed by this large infusion of infrastructure dollars that puts broadband as a critical piece of infrastructure. Representative Sora.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I don't know if Dr. Lynn, Dr. Lynn, is really good with us. I know, and I can't remember what year, there's been a grant from the legislature to, like, in building schools, capitals, essentially, with a prototype, you know, of schools to get the same class. I think Representative Fairbrew, she led that study, I don't remember what year, she was the impetus for that, and they looked at what can we do to help with those costs? And I'm trying to remember the results of that, but there were many reasons why just having one prototype for a school would not work in Alaska. But I know the front of the funders and going down the road and, you know, trying to get that cost, which doesn't mean, I mean, we're always trying to do that, but it's, sometimes it's just wrestling with the fact that it's going to cost more to do things here. But I don't have any more efficiencies. That's right, I think it's about, I remember that study, and I know that Representative Fairclough and then subsequently who became Senator McCullough was invested in the three prototype schools that we built in Oakland. I think there are at least 15, if not 20, elementary schools in Anchorage that have been built on the same model. And as a former Anchorage school board member, I guarantee you it doesn't cost any less to build an elementary school for 500 kids in South Anchorage than it does in Eagle River. But there is a small savings in the design cost because once the architect has designed a particular prototype, yeah, they can pretty much plant it over anywhere. But there are site differences, and all of those things have to be accounted for. And then you're talking about, if you're talking about building a prototype school in rural Alaska, the economy of scale does not exist in rural Alaska. Anchorage has 90 schools. There's going to be some economy of scale. But still, construction costs are tremendous. In fact, I'm going to say it right here, and I've been observing it for years. In the 90s and early 2000s, it cost $10 to $12 million to build an elementary school for 500 kids in Anchorage. Today, the bond issue and scale in Anchorage is building an elementary school for $35 million. That's three times the cost that it cost in the 90s. Teachers in the 90s, beginning teachers in Anchorage, I remember when the contract negotiations were getting about $33,000 entry-level teachers. The contract that was just settled in Anchorage, entry-level teachers were $56,000. That's not even twice. If they're making the 90s, it may cost three times as much to build a school. And I don't see anybody telling the contractors they need to lower their prices. Representative Price.
Thank you, Chair. I just think, I've pointed you, maybe that the bond something we need to think about. Well, I'll tell you, part of what the problem is that bond issue would have to be 100% paid by Enbridge taxpayers. While in the past, the state has reimbursed school bond debt, and Enbridge bond issues for schools used to be reimbursed by the state at 65%. So the local taxpayers only had to pay 45% of that. That's obvious. If somebody else is paying for it, of course you want more of whatever it is. We all pay for it, representative parties, whether it's Enbridge taxpayers or the state. The state taxpayers.
That might be the point. It is, but basically, the Enbridge, it's the same on that plane of people in Enbridge, but the Enbridge, if Enbridge is asking the state to pay for something without thinking that they're being the same, probably everybody else is doing the same thing. If the cost is disconnected from the value of the service, you're going to want more of it. That's obvious.
It's been free for too long. It costs money to build schools and operate them. And representative,
I think we need to answer a quick question. What is the expression of debt?
Move
between schools because of the specialized ability to work. But I would have to look at what you're looking at to know exactly what you're talking about. But there are a lot of instructional support individuals who are highly trained and specialized outside of the certificated staff member or salary schedule. I'll say the data room, I should talk about it. I'm certainly have on our workloads, and it's certainly something we can do, but as Kate noted, in all the work that I'm doing right now, if there's 2020 data, I'm like putting an asterisk next to it to say that this was such a bizarre year. Beyond education, it was such a bizarre year in the way that we accommodated schools and everything we got here during the pandemic. I don't know how useful that is as a comparative or as an indication of where we stand, moving forward. I'm hoping that that year was an anomaly and we never have another one like it in terms of school closures. So I would ask, would those numbers still have value, representative story for the chair?
Thank you, for the chair. I guess when I look at the numbers, I think about all the federal dollars that each state collects, so every state's number is going to be up if the statistics come from the United States where we got the federal aid. So I hear what you're saying. I understand what you're saying too, and I can be fine with that. My concern is because I know that I'm just interested in the 2020 studies.
Thank you. To the chair, Dr. DeFeo, looking at the way that we all want to hear since the beginning of this conversation, compare apples to apples, any other nationwide studies that you've done, and I'm understanding those numbers often need to be taken with a grain of salt, but have you seen any places where every number that are adjusted to the national average? Have other states that have also been adjusted to the national average and where we've like at that point, like utilizing, the state-specific safety aisle for their emergency or something like that, or how it impacts them, and where that could place Alaska on for people spending once we account for the different states' individual impacts?
To Dr. Berman, but I would add that this is where we compare to the national average if we only use the written quarter when we were talking about the raw dollars. But I don't know if Dr. Berman would like to add. If I'm understanding your question correctly, you're saying, could we compare, say, Alaska to another? How are people spending state and just some adjustments and see residents say in Alaska and New York or New Jersey. How New Jersey compares, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
So, and I'm kind of sure, you know, Dr. Roman, but I would say that one of the ways that we're able to do these adjustments is our familiarity with Alaska and understanding all of the intricacies of the finance here. So, Dr. Berman, would that be possible?
Spend a lot more money on their schools compared to poorer communities, and then yet the state goes after them and says that you have to have adequate education in every community, and they don't let the wealthier communities necessarily get away with spending more money. districts or funding mechanisms to provide schools in the small communities and to adequately fund them. So, perfect. The MOOC settlement, I think, said there shall be a school in every community. If it is silent, and more versus state, which is the more recent one. And I'm not well versed on all of them, but I think it's worth remembering that that government's what we do. Representative Story.
Well, you know, so I was thinking about a little bit tonight, what perhaps, how important it is that we talk about the outcomes that we're looking for. I'll have slides for that in a letter when we were talking about the House Bill 272 and 273, the best adoption bill from the Fair Banks District, Dr. Rod, I believe, sanitation from Fair Banks. And when you talk about outcomes, of course, in our schools, one thing is there's your scores that you get on your mandate. For example, if you was talking about the National Association of Academic Progress, I'm saying it wrong, but as he was saying, your community could look at the study out of Stanford when they have rated the student growth on the fourth grade Stanford major score. It's noticed that Alaska was number two with student growth. Which we think is an outcome, of course, if you want student growth. Arizona actually is number one with measuring student growth, and I think these were 2017, 2019 numbers. But that is an outcome that I certainly would want to see, that once we have the students with us, that they are making some growth in their learning. And they were in Alaska, that was number two. We had that positive growth students had made. So I'll make sure you go back to all of the data that you have left on your desk yesterday during our budgeting session, but that is certainly something positive that we will make sure that we all know. But I'm not sure if I recall how the discussion of outcomes, I think we all have other graduation rates. I guess we can even review what Dean has. They mentioned they looked at SAT, ACT scores, and I know that has been a positive for our students who take them. Our scores have been part of the product with national average. So it's not Dr. DeFeo nodding her head, but maybe Dr. DeFeo, Dr. Burns, since we have you here, what sort of outcomes do you see that our district's looking for other states? And certainly it would be easy for us to come up with our own here, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
If I can share this, so I'm just going to have a quick point. Graduation rates by state is so simple. And even those are really complicated because how those are reported at the national level. I have to pull up an ISTR report. I will forward it following this meeting. But the adjusted cohort graduation rates and how these are calculated and reported was done very differently by all different states and districts until it was standardized in 2015. So I would just note that for any outcome, if you're going to try to look at it at a national level or state level, even graduation rate, which seems so simple, how many went in, how many came out, even that has changed significantly. And I can send you some examples there. I'll note that even in the state of Alaska, different districts have different graduation requirements. So a high school diploma in one district might be a little bit different from a diploma in another district. There's a minimum that those districts can have in that one. So it's another one of those things that's comparing apples to apples can be quite tricky. And the devil is in the details, as Dr. Berman says, and making sure that when we're looking at these things that, for example, in Alaska, that they jump in graduation rate that correlated with, the elimination of high school qualifying exam, I think that was in 2012. So, when we change the rules, we're going to see changes in the outcomes, which makes it very, very hard for us to compare one year to the next. But how that presents with more students during school, hopefully high school. We'd like to see more students meeting different milestones that we have set at different grade levels. But again, as Dr. Roman said, with the standardized measures, those are pretty contentious and tricky. But we want all students to achieve those milestones. Setting them is hard. Measuring them is even harder. I don't think I answered your question or was that a story, but I hope to indicate and this is also in response to Dr. Crump's interest in Representative Crump's formal analysis to outcomes. But it's not for lack of interest in doing this, it's not for lack of desire to understand how these investments produce outcomes. It's that the world is such a complex place and it's always changing. And so to measure these things and to do it with any degree of certainty or any, to accommodate all of these changes and errors and to make conclusions that are in fact sound is tricky. And the fact that we extrapolate the intervention from the outcome, the more additional variables get added in there that we have to accommodate. So I don't think I answered your question, but I don't know if Dr. Roman would like to add in view of how much easier answer than I do.
Thank you.
that kind of conversation. I do want to mention that in Anchorage, the United Way had an effort to achieve a 90% graduation rate by 2020, and they did pretty close to that. But I know that one of the things Anchorage realized they had to do, they couldn't download it before your graduation rate out of high school. They had to track the kids who didn't finish in 4 years, but did finish in 5 years. They call it the fifth-year rate. And they put that together with the four-year rate, the graduation rate was really very good. And as Dr. DeFeo pointed out, there were a lot of tests that were also sensitive in the earlier part of this decade. And it makes it much more difficult to compare outcomes. Dr. DeFeo, you had one up.
Thank you. I was just going to note that I'll send you a paper that we wrote on Alaska's high school graduation rate trends, but that fifth-year graduation rate is very important. I'm wondering if I could share my screen, but I'm just going through it. By including that fifth-year in graduation rate calculations, that strongly benefits the rates of low-income students and students of color. And so if we're looking at a four-year graduation rate, the gap between low-income students and economically stable students and the gap between students of color and the gap and white students is much more pronounced than if we allow that fifth year. And I would note that the reasons that we have a fifth year and that, we should talk about that fifth year as well and what some students need it. But again, it's just a slightly different way to look at success as a five-year graduation rate, and some of the performance gaps change drastically. And that's, I was just going to add to what Representative Cameron said, not just in Alaska, but at a statewide level. And I'm looking at a little chart. I'll forward this to you so you can take a look. But one of the things that we've noted as well is that Alaska graduation rates have grown and increased just using the adjusted cohort model that they started using, I believe, in 2015. We've been doing better. That is, I think, a strong success story for Alaska, but measuring that, just like measuring any outcome, there's all of its little details to consider. But I was glad to hear about the five-year graduation rate. It is an important thing if we want to look at success for some of our economically stable, I'm sorry, our low-income and non-white students.
Thank you. I'm glad you reminded me of the five-year graduation rate, and I look forward to sharing that, those statistics. To me, it's critical that we remember how much we invest in each of our children in this state, and to not include the fifth-year students is saying that that's not worth it, that what we've invested in them up to the 12th year is not important, but it's vitally important, and that contributes to their ability and willingness to finish in their fifth year. So we've got to count them and give them credit for working incredibly hard and getting there and not giving up. It's any progress.
It's essential in the book that we have to talk about performance, not just nebulous terms like graduate and thought, with what ability did they graduate. I think everybody should be going master and test in order to graduate from high school. Some people might disagree with me if I had that discussion.
Thank you, Representative Cox. Representative Dillon.
Thank you, Manager. The graduation rate, is that taking into account the high school students?
I believe it is. There are homeschool students in many school districts that the homeschool program or correspondence school is run by the school district, so they do count. I don't know how you would count students that are enrolled in a school district.
No, I don't want to have to move on, but I wanted to finally agree with Representative Props. You can ask me now, but for me, what does that graduation mean? It means that they
classes to get the necessary credits that the district and the school think determined that you need to show that they even learned about in school. But that means they have to learn tests. That means they learn some facts. Does that mean that are those specifically the outcomes that we're looking for? Or are we going to look at outcomes that get you confident enough in order to become a grandmaster in chess? Is it the outcomes that the personal of the year, Robin Johnson, was down here a few weeks ago and has gotten to many of us about in individual meetings, where he feels her students' pride and students' growth and their confidence and their abilities to go out into the world and accomplish them, not being able to recite specific facts. Like we have a bill in this committee right now that says you shouldn't give your head till you can pass this, you know, nationwide citizenship test with some Alaska pet test. Is that preparing you for the world, or is it giving you all the skills you need through a solid education that gives you the confidence and the ability to overcome obstacles, be a good team player, know that you're going to be able to be employed because you have those social skills and then the confidence in yourself to learn, while also having, you know, learned to read and to do your math, your multiplication tables, although my math teacher's always told me you never have a calculator in your pocket all the time, and surprise, now we do. What does that student progress mean? What are those outcomes? What do those mean? And is it a certain number of credits that you achieve? Because we do have to have some sort of tape that you can cut through to say we've gone through the school to be able to graduate and get that diploma. But what are those skills that we also want to make sure students learn? I think that perhaps we have out of it. What does it mean to graduate? And what does it mean to be ready to graduate as well? How do we teach those skills? Because when we're looking at national averages, I mentioned it before, we had a national average of 15 students per class, but I'd argue that we have probably some of the smallest school districts in the entire nation. And how they're funded is going to be different maybe than those other places that are even comparable size. And we have, you know, a pretty big school district in Anchorage that's one of the top 100 size in the nation. And so when you average those together, you don't get a picture of Alaska. You get a picture for a study. You get a picture for a specific number that we need to see, but those numbers don't translate to students. Those numbers don't translate to individual problems, because when you have a class of, you know, a school of 12 kids, and that school district has to pay for the small capital improvements of that, you have to pay for when those windows break, and how much does it cost to get that window broken, that window that's broken fixed in a small village versus an Anchorage or Fairbanks or Matsu. Now, actually, that's costly in an Anchorage, so that's one of the reasons we need to make the district cost factor into the adequacy studies. But when we boil this question down to just numbers and specific national averages versus the test score, we miss the depth of what we've been listening to in this community that is Alaska, and the impact of how we teach in rural Alaska, how we educate our students in rural Alaska, and the impact it has on their ability to learn, because we're not preparing them and we're not meeting those students where they are. We're trying to drag those students into where everybody else in this nation is, and that's setting up a fan, and that's impacting our test scores, and that's impacting our teacher turnover, and that's impacting our teacher housing, and that's impacting our ability to recruit and retain on this national competitive level. We might be 10th in the nation, as you said, representative, you know, of our salaries. We used to be number one. And now we're way down. And when you have to go from, you know, going through the college at Oklahoma, living at your parents' house, and trying to grab a job, and you go out to rural Alaska because you see a pay scale, but you don't look at what housing's going to be, you don't look at a picture of what that town's going to look like on Google, and you get there and there's no store in that community, and they turn around and leave or don't even get off the plane, or they stay 1 year. Do not become an effective good teacher, and as Ms. DeFeo said, in anchor, Dr. DeFeo said, that is one of the top drivers in a good teacher. And if we have all these issues playing into what a district has to pay and where the funding is, and it comes down to also not being able to recruit and retain that teacher because of all the impacts on that school, it takes so long to fix that window, that classroom window. The library is a shelf, one shelf of books, versus the library that they knew in their elementary school growing up, which was a giant hall, giant room. That's where we start losing the fact that it's not just numbers that we are looking at, but just people these numbers tie into each other in many different ways, and it's not just one specific number that we should be looking at. It's what we want to teach our students so that they're learning and ready to graduate and ready to go out into the world. And this discussion is really kind of important because that is what we look at in this research report to us, is just the numbers and what it costs. And when we look at national studies from ADA, that doesn't take into a lot of really looks like there are problems to pay out. And we're trying to listen to that in this committee with strong testimony on culturally based education and what this should look like going forward. So these studies are incredibly critical sometimes to the discussions about what we have in these halls. The informal public discussions are disappointing because they look at microcosms and not the overall web of funding and web of issues that plays into the success that our students find in the end. Thank you.
As Representative Arkansas, I think I mentioned that one of the areas of study that you didn't address in your passion just now, the kids that want to be carpenters, electricians, veterinary and health technicians, small boat operators, resource miners, all of our schools are crying out for an institute and very successful. There are technology programs. There are, and the big school districts can afford to build their own facilities, but smaller districts have a lot more to use. And 9,000 smaller districts are addressing that lack of career tech facilities very creatively and by using several residential programs in other communities. One of them has bought a building in the Bridge and brings their kids in for incentives in which they share and purchase career tech facilities. And I think that's been a real success story. And it's producing kids that have all kinds of skills, not just academic skills, but I know that not only State Department of Education, but many of our school districts' missions are to produce students that will succeed in life, and that includes all of these issues that we've been discussing here today. And if we get those carpenters and electricians to help build schools more efficiently in rural Alaska, that will have made quite a bit of progress. Representative Stewart?
I really say I appreciate all of the thoughts and comments. I was also talking about just like what prerequisite we would be talking about, and I want other members in here, myself included. I just want to respect how graduation rates are different from different districts. And I think that the middle one at the state level, and as an example, who needs to be down to graduate, you need to have two math grades. That's right. Just 2 years of math in high school to graduate, and we were finding a lot of our kids trying to go to secondary institutions are not doing well on assessments like academics or at UIS and then of course one measure. And so we put in after 3 years of math. Really good more passages for that, but we thought we were doing a disservice to kids to say that they had 2 years of math and then they had a 2 year break and then if they wanted to walk in and go secondary, which was vocational training or university, they were just not ready to perform. And so, and I know we all have different credits that are high schools. And we put that in the Anchorage Employer, that's one of the smaller districts requiring the board to have students to have 3 years of math. But we think that the school district has it's a good service to our students. But those are all sort of different. What we want our kids to have when they leave high school, different school boards, there are minimal standards that we set the different school boards are setting their own to. I just want to say thank you to the kids that are student. I think it is good that we're aware of national studies and that we're aware of what's unique to Alaska so we can talk to people about them and answer those questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
I just want to thank the Republican Research Conference. I just think I probably agree with the majority of you.
people are even listening. So, you know, there'd be the answers, and it's going to be a lot of people, but I'm currently continuing working together to get there. Thank you.
Yeah, we've spent a long week talking about farming and how we're appropriating ourselves to get that, and that is our job. But we have to get back to our reading bills, our policy, and get a bunch of issues outstanding that we will be getting to, I promise. So I appreciate that observation. And I wanted to say, just in follow-up to our next story, just said, remember my first year as a Lincoln School Board, we fought tooth and nail to increase the math requirements from 2 years to 2.5, I think it was. And we barely had the votes to do that. And as Mark Starr says, it benefits the students in the long run. I think we had just 4 votes out of 7 to increase the math requirement back in the 90s. And that's embarrassing. But we're better off for giving kids more ability to be on their own path. Right now, of course, we have the top holders in our pockets to help us out. Thank you.